Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's episode, we're going to be looking at the history of civil rights and tolerance in Minnesota, specifically following the Civil War. Joining me on the phone is Augsburg College professor Bill Green, who will be coming to town this Wednesday, September 21st, to give a presentation to the Granite City Book Club at the Good Earth Food Co-op. He'll be talking about his book, Degrees of Freedom, The Origins of Civil Rights in Minnesota from 1865 to 1912. Degrees of Freedom gives us an idea of the Black experience in our northern state during this difficult time in our country, and it provides lessons that certainly can be applicable to today's world. So, Bill, thanks for joining me today on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. So how about we start with, what led you to this topic and what led you to Minnesota?
Well, I'm from New Orleans, and I always wanted to study abroad, and, you know, so my folks sent me to Minnesota. This is back in 1968. I went to Gustavus. And found it to be a very interesting, deceptively interesting place, in large part because very few people really knew the history of the region, let alone their own history. And, I mean, coming from New Orleans, you know, you walk down a street and history is just kind of hanging from the trees, like, you know,
yeah, literally
Spanish moss. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So to come to a place like Minnesota where everything seemed to be understated and nuanced, it was a different world for me. And, you know, I began to become kind of interested in why that was the case. And then, you know, you couple that with the fact that even though there were very few Black people who lived here, in the middle part of the 20th century, some of the national leaders, many of the national leaders of civil rights, had Minnesota contacts or connections. And I wanted to examine, you know, what was the connection between this state, that history, predominantly Northern European, with it providing a ground, fertile ground for civil rights discussions. So that began really the impetus for the research that I got into.
Yeah, interesting, because if you think about it, yeah, we're Minnesota is that, you know, kind of Northern European heritage, and yeah. You wouldn't, you know, that is kind of an interesting juxtaposition there, because other states up this way, you know, thinking back to Professor Lehman's books, he talked about how Iowa and Illinois, on one hand, you know, they didn't have slavery, but also they had laws that basically outlawed people of color from entering the state.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so right. It's kind of like, well, where did this idea come from? You know, looking out for one another, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the time periods kind of give us some insight into what's going on. He's absolutely correct in talking about the common practice of slave ownership, despite federal law that prohibited slavery in the Northwestern territories. But it's an example of old practices carried over from French Dominion, for example, in the fur trade. Slavery was a common practice, and then it was further fueled by the policy of John C. Calhoun, you know, of Calhoun Lake Calhoun fame, who was the Secretary of War in the 1820s. Who wanted to create a policy or some sort of inducement for Army officers to bring their wives to the forts in the Northwest, Fort Snelling is an example of that. And the inducement took the form of allowances so that the gentlewomen of the officer ranks, who are used to a little bit much more refinement and comfort in Eastern residences, would be able to purchase a servant to provide for their needs out here in the frontier. And a colleague of ours, Walt Bachman, who I would encourage you to talk with him as well if you get a chance to, wrote a book on a biography of Joseph Godfrey, who was a slave born in Minnesota, owned by Alexis Bailey and by one of the Faribolds. And he later ran away from slavery and joined the Dakota people and participated actually in the Dakota War in 1862. But one of the things that Bachman, who writes that story, did was to document the allowance system that the War Department created to allow officers to purchase slaves, basically, in St. Louis and bring them up the river. And then, of course, you have the work of Leah Vandervelt, who published a book called Mrs. Dred Scott, in which she looks at the role of Harriet Scott in the lawsuit that became so famous in 1857, Dred Scott versus Sanford. Mm-hmm. And she also just recently published a book called Freedom Songs, which is about when slaves were brought to free soil and then taken back to the South. Slaves oftentimes contested their slavery by saying, by virtue of having set foot on free soil, I'm free, and that they would take these suits to court in Missouri, where many of them had been purchased. And Missouri courts, at least in the 1820s and 1830s, would free slaves. So it's one reason why Dred Scott was argued down there. But the point that I'm making is that in both slaveholding Missouri and free soil Illinois and Iowa and, you know, southern Wisconsin, the institution of slavery was well in living. You know, it's quite dynamic. Slaveholders would bring slaves to the lead mines in the southern part of Wisconsin in the Galena lead mine area, Galena, Illinois. And so you'd see slaves that far being worked openly in a public. So you had on one hand, you know, that is the 1830s and 40s. By the time you get to the 50s and you see massive immigration of Northern Europeans into Minnesota, you see kind of a different sensibility take place. The reform, progressive, abolitionist sensibility, you know, that you typically associate with New England, mm-hmm. And New York State, they're moving into this region. And so that kind of creates a dual society, one that on one hand is Republican-oriented with a small r and very much interested in reform, and you have on the other hand the kind of democratic sense where that tolerated the institution of slavery. Both forces are living in Minnesota.
Oh, it's like a tapestry to society, if you will.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, from Chris's writings, and I know you're familiar with this anyway, you know, one of the more prominent Anglo-American slaveholders was right there in St. Cloud, Sylvanus Lowry.
Yep.
And he's notorious for throwing the print press, the abolitionist press owned by Jane Grey Swisshelm, into the Mississippi River.
Absolutely.
So...
Yeah, the one of the neighborhood associations up here had a little haunted St. Cloud neighborhood tour where they had historical ghosts talking about the different, you know, the different things that they did, and one of them was her, and having a description of, you know, she came out there and she was kind of the founder of what is now the St. Cloud Times, and originally, yeah, people were like, well, you can't see these things, so yeah, they threw a printing press into the river. It's well, and that's kind of one of these things where this is something I've noticed is, you know, there is this ongoing history with, you know, it's kind of a side-by-side thing with you know, African-Americans and then also these other immigrants, and they're mostly German and Norwegian, and it's like everyone who's showing up here is new except for the Native Americans, and then there's that interaction as well, and it's kind of interesting to see where our culture today comes from. I don't think that we really, you know, as a society kind of grasp where we come from.
Right.
Or we maybe grasp onto, you know, some kind of myth of what we think of where we came from. I think this is probably a common myth that maybe you run into, you know, teaching and everything. People think, you know, the Civil War happened and then poof, everything was better because somebody won.
That's right.
But, you know, this continues into even the Black Lives Matter movement.
Right.
Because, you know, there are two different societies. There's the folks that, you know, hey, everything's cool. Just work and do your job and get a paycheck and everything's fine. And then there's other side of society where it's like, well, yeah, but you don't have to worry about being pulled over and searched all the time. You right. don't have to, you know, you don't have this level of discrimination. You know, and if it's not affecting your life directly, you don't really realize it's there.
That's right.
Until you see it.
That's exactly right. And sometimes even seeing it is not interpreted in a way that actually is played out. I mean, you know, people see what's going on with the police shootings, but they still have a hard time believing that that's anything other than an extraordinary situation.
Yeah, like so, anecdotal instead of a statistical reality, that kind
right.
of thing.
That's right. That's right.
Hmm. So what kind of we're actually talking about kind of sort of talking about you're coming up to St. Cloud for the Granite City Book Club, and you're going to be discussing your book, Degrees of Freedom.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that time period, like post-Civil War? And this is actually part of a multi-volume series that you're in the process of writing, correct?
I think so, yeah. I think so, yes. This particular book, Degrees of Freedom, covers the period between generally 1865, mid-1860s, to 1914. And what I attempt to do in that book is to look not only at the evolution of a civil rights consciousness in Minnesota, but also the unwieldy kind of nuanced relationship between blacks and whites, even in the context of liberalism. You know, how it was possible for rights to be established, but opportunity and equality to still be evasive. And how it was difficult for African Americans to articulate the challenges that remained. You can legislate, you can put a law that basically says you have the right to vote, but you can't legislate away the racist impulse that so many felt. This was a place that frowned on the kinds of tragedies that were occurring in the Deep South and viewing it as a Southern phenomenon, but to a far lesser violent degree, but to a corrosive degree, it was a society that pretty much tolerated, if not enforced, segregation. It discouraged blacks from participating freely in society, even though there was a law that protected their right to do so. And it was hard to talk about that because racism was viewed as on the same level as a bad business deal or a failed farm. Okay, nature takes its course. Your job is to overcome it if you're going to be a true, you know, self-made American. And oftentimes policymakers viewed racism in the same context as a failed business. In other words, racism is something that you can overcome. and there was little shrift given to the subtle and corrosive elements of racism that existed during that time. So it was hard for people to have a conversation. You know, it's kind of like what you just suggested, where a lot of people are intellectually aware of the problems facing Black America today, but don't really believe that it is as bad as it seems because we have a Black president.
Yeah. And it kind of like what you said also with is something you can overcome. Like if you've got bad vision, you can put on glasses.
That's right.
And then, okay, everything will be better.
That's right.
Yeah. And also something that popped into my head was a Saturday Night Live skit from way back when in Eddie Murphy. He did this thing where he put on white makeup and then
I remember that.
I saw that as a kid and I'm like, well, that's really funny. And then I kind of thought about it. I grew up in Waterloo, Iowa. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but it's it's one of the cities of Iowa. And during, you know, the Black migration from way back when, a lot of people came up because it was industrial and there were a lot of jobs there with John Deere and the packing companies and everything. So I grew up with, you know, African-American classmates. My dad's boss was African-American. So it didn't really sink in that there was something. You kind of see something like, oh, they have darker skin, but everything is the same. You know, they've got a house, they go to my school, they have what? But then it was much later that you start getting these hints of, wait, there is something different that's going on. And, you know, it's kind of like an atmosphere that's out there that you don't really, it's just there and you don't notice it until you notice it. And I think that maybe, and you know, this is one of these things where, you know, a tragic event happens and then people pay attention a little bit more and they're like, okay, wait, maybe we have to fix something. I mean, do you kind of agree with that, or do you
think absolutely. Absolutely. And when something tragic happens, it's as if, you know, everybody's shocked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're surprised that it happened. We thought that we had gone past that moment. So, yeah, I agree with you completely on that. And that just underscores the, you know, the nature of, I mean, what my book attempts to do is to show how we could have parallel universes in a society where the population is relatively small, you know, how it was possible for Blacks and whites to live in separate worlds, and how it made it as a result difficult for people to really talk to each other in a candid way. Blacks and whites did not have the kind of relationship that I think a lot of whites thought existed during that time. Blacks didn't feel that they could be candid with whites without showing a degree of ingratitude. And that was always hanging over the head of African-American leaders during the second half of the 19th century, because after all, a lot of their white friends had done noble things. They had fought in the war. They had ended slavery, defeated the Confederacy. They had voted, since they were the only ones who could vote. They had voted to abolish slavery and to create the 14th and 15th Amendments. They had done that. And so, you know, with that kind of accomplishment, you know, their white friends felt self-satisfied. What more do we need to do? You know, why, you know, it's all on you now to do something. And Black folks, on the other hand, at that time were saying, we feel compelled to vindicate the work of our white friends by being self-sufficient, except self-sufficiency in a context where people denied you of employment, you know, or skilled labor, or adequate education, as was the case in the second half of the 19th century, created another generation of menial workers. And that becomes, and many of their white friends did not see the connection to that consequence and what they had done by omission or failed to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how does this, I guess you could say, how does this all translate into today's world? And, you know, where can we keep going from here?
Well, I think these kinds of conversations are key. Because, you know, we just got news that the economy has improved, mm-hmm. and that jobs, are increasing. But, you know, to look at the strip, from, I think it was yesterday, on the front page, it showed that everybody's doing better. It seems this is a broad stroke here, but everybody seemed to be doing better in terms of employment, except for minorities and in general and black people in particular. So even though things look well, it seems that we have to teach ourselves to resist the temptation to feel that we can now move on to something else, you know. And that frequently is what has happened in the past. Okay, we won the war. We passed these amendments. Now we can move on to something else. And in the case of Minnesota, that something else was trying to create a new economy that was based on industrialization and a workforce that we could use cheaply. That's the immigrants moving into the cities. The rights of blacks in the North kind of got overshadowed by that type of tension. So it's really kind of creating a dialogue that goes against human impulse to want to kind of move on to something different.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we've crossed that finish line, and now let's do something else now. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. I mean, with Brown versus Board of Education, we assumed that, you know, school integration was going to improve quality of education for blacks. And, you know, the numbers are what they are in 2016, 50 years later, 50-plus years later. We still have an achievement gap. Notice that's not even on the national agenda. I mean, we don't hear either candidate really debating this issue. I think that I do believe that at least one of the candidates cares about quality of education, but it is not an issue.
Uh-huh.
It's not something that's part of the agenda. And I remember having dinner with Jeffrey Toobin, who was in town. And I mean, I was part of a group that had dinner with him. It wasn't a personal thing. And this was during the time when Elena Kagan was being considered for the Supreme Court. And she's a progressive. She's a liberal. I asked him, I said, do you think that she will be asked any questions dealing with law affecting desegregation? You know, we'll deal with adequate education, things of that nature. And he said, oh, absolutely not. Nobody's going to bring it up. You know, I mean, nobody's going to bring it up. And you know, so policymakers, even our friends, don't bring it up because there's a sense that the constituents have no will to grapple with that stuff. So as a result, public education, you know, and the education of kids of color, you know, is not even on the national part of the national debate.
Yeah, and actually, it hasn't been for quite a while.
No.
Yeah, I think back to,
and it's still a problem.
Oh yeah. I've taught writing at the college level, and oh, trust me, I know. This is one of those, the evolution of education is definitely a strange thing. You know, on one hand, you know, we've got all these new electronic gadgets coming into the classroom and everybody's got their tablets and everything, you know, to the point where nobody's learning how to write cursive anymore.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you've got the system of funding the schools, you know, if it's still based off of property tax. Well,
yep,
that's a thing. And then you got to hold teachers accountable by testing the students, and you've got standardized testing, and you've got teachers teaching to the test, and then you don't have creative things taught anymore because let's cut those, but yet those are the most useful tools in encouraging learning in the first place.
That's right.
So it gets, yeah, it gets to be this very complex, strange system, and you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why the candidates don't bring it up, is because it's confusing.
It's very confusing, and it makes people kind of feel a sense of hopelessness. This is too complicated, and therefore, I you know, it can't be solved. And I'm learning to live with the recognition that this stuff is not solvable.
Oh,
you know.
Oh.
So therefore, we're going to go back to, you know, it's up to you to beat the odds. You know, that was a mantra. Not too long ago, we wanted to celebrate those people who beat the odds. Well, everybody should be, you know, I mean, there shouldn't be odds for people to have to beat, but we're accepting the impediments, you know, because it's easier to celebrate a kid who becomes an exception to the rule.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in getting back to your book, Degrees of Freedom, The Origins of Civil Rights in Minnesota, what was one of the ways that you kind of organized and crafted the stories that really drive maybe the narrative?
You know, basically, I was interested in the role of barbers and the role of entrepreneurs and lawyers. Those are the three categories of African-American leaders that I looked at. They each had different roles for different times. And each of them had to be mindful of the limits that they were able to push any agenda, and the limits to which they would be able to ask for support. They couldn't demand too much. So there's kind of this dance going on. You know, I'm going to push this far, but not farther, because the bottom line is I don't want to alienate my friends. That's characteristic, I think, of the late 19th century. Politics of racial politics of the time.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Certain professions kind of stand out more than others.
Right.
Excellent. Well, Bill Green, thank you for speaking to me today on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota.
Jeff, thank you so much for the interest and the chance to talk.
And we've been talking today with Augsburg College professor Bill Green about his book, Degrees of Freedom, The Origin of Civil Rights in Minnesota from 1865 to 1912. Bill Green will be coming up to St. Cloud on Wednesday, September 21st for the Granite City Book Club. And they'll be meeting at 6:30 p.m. at the Good Earth Food Co-op off of Veterans Drive in St. Cloud. For more information on the Granite City Book Club and other work by Bill Green, you can find links on our website at kvsc.org under the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab and the link for this story. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPERTS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.